Panic in his eyes, Grace expected an outburst, perhaps even a violent one. She glanced at Benjamin. He had to be ready. But Daniel only looked intently at Leo.
What did you really give him?
It wasn't a sedative, was it? She did not answer. She was unsure now how best to play her cards. She knew that every word, every nuance in her voice could be decisive.
Curare,
she said eventually.
And what's that?
A plant-based poison.
Why the hell did you give him poison? Dan was shouting again.
Because I thought it necessary, she said.
Like a desperate animal caught in a trap, Daniel looked up at Benjamin.
But then you gave him something else.
Physostigmine. It's an antidote, she said.
Okay, so now let's take him to the hospital. Greitz said nothing, and so he picked up his mobile. She considered telling Benjamin to take it from him, but as long as he made no calls, there was no danger. She guessed he was googling information on Curare, and she let him search for a while. But when she saw fear in his eyes, she snatched the phone from him. He went crazy. He yelled and flailed about, and even Benjamin had difficulty restraining him.
Calm down, Daniel.
Never.
Don't you understand that I'm giving you a fantastic gift? She said.
I don't want to hear it, he screamed.
She told him that physostigmine would suspend the effect of the curare for only a short time.
So you can't save him?
His voice was barely human.
I'm so sorry,
she lied, and Benjamin had no choice but to silence him. As he taped Daniel's mouth shut, Greitz voiced her regret at having to go through all this, and explained in more detail that Leo's respiratory muscles would soon be blocked again, that he would suffocate and die. She looked at him.
We have a difficult situation on our hands, Daniel. Leo is near death, and we not only have your fingerprints on the syringe, we also have a clear motive, don't we? I see in your eyes just how envious you are of everything he has. But there's a plus side.
Daniel was struggling to hit out left and right, trying to tear himself free.
The plus side is that Leo can go on living. But in a different way, Daniel. Through you.
She gestured around the apartment.
You can have his life, his money and opportunities, an existence you could only have dreamed of before. You can take over, Daniel. You can have it, and I promise you, all the terrible things Leo's done, his despicable greed will never come to light. We'll see to it. We'll back you up in every way. The fact that your mirror-image twins could present some difficulties, admittedly, but you're so extraordinarily alike. Everything will be fine, I just know it.
At that very moment, Greitz heard a sound she could not identify. It was one of Daniel's teeth, which he had ground to pieces. Chapter 20 June 22nd Leo Mannheimer, at last, emerged from his office in a light blue linen suit, grey T-shirt and sneakers, and Blomqvist got up to shake his hand. It was a peculiar meeting. Blomqvist had spent a great deal of time researching this man, and here they were, standing eye to eye. It was immediately apparent that there was something unspoken and painful hanging over him, like a shadow, a phantom. Leo was nervously rubbing his hands together. His nails were long and neat, his hair curly and a little dishevelled, and he seemed to be listening out for something. He looked tense and did not ask Blomqvist to come through, so instead they stood in the large lobby in front of the reception desk.
"I enjoyed your conversation with Karin Leistander at the Fotografiska Museum," Blomqvist said.
"Thanks," Leo said. "It was..."
"Clever," Blomqvist cut in, "and true. We're living in a time when lies and false news reports have more of an impact than ever. Or should I say, alternative facts."
"The Post-Truth Society," Leo replied, and hesitantly returned Blomqvist's smile.
"Indeed. And we play around with our identities too, don't we? Pretend to be people we're not, on Facebook and so on."
"I'm not actually on Facebook."
"Me neither. I've never really understood the point. But I sometimes mess around with different identities too," Blomqvist said. "It's part of my job. How about you?"
Leo glanced at his wristwatch and looked out the window at the square.
"I'm so sorry," he said. "I have wall-to-wall meetings today. What is it you wanted to see me about?"
What do you think?
I really have no idea.
Anything you've had second thoughts about? Anything that would interest my magazine? Millennium?
Leo swallowed hard. He gave the question serious consideration, and then, looking at the floor, he said,
I suppose over the years I've done a few deals which could have been handled better. They're a bit of a mess.
I'd be happy to take a look at them, Blomqvist said. Messes are my speciality. But just now I'm interested in more personal matters. Small divergences, let's say.
Divergences?
Exactly.
Such as?
Such as you becoming right-handed.
Leo, if indeed it was Leo, seemed to be listening out for something again. He ran his fingers through his hair.
I haven't, actually. I just changed around. I've always used both hands.
So you write equally well with your right and your left hand?
Roughly speaking.
Could you show me?
Blomqvist pulled out a pen and his reporter's notebook.
I'd rather not.
Sweat beaded on Leo's upper lip. He looked away.
Are you feeling okay?
No, I can't say that I am.
It must be the heat.
Perhaps.
I'm not in the best shape myself, Blomqvist said. I was up half the night drinking with Hilda von Kantaborg.
You know her, don't you?
Blomqvist saw fear in the man's eyes and realized that he had him. He could tell by his look, by the way he squirmed. But maybe, Blomqvist was watching him very carefully, there was something else, too. Something hard to define, a hint of impatience, perhaps, and also doubt, as if Leo, or whoever it might be, was confronting a major decision.
Hilda told me an unbelievable story, Blomqvist said.
Is that so?
It was about twins who had been separated at birth.
One of the boys was named Daniel Brolin. He had to work like a dog on a farm outside Hudiksvall, while his twin brother,
not so loud, the man interrupted.
Excuse me?
Blomqvist pretended to be surprised and looked at him.
Perhaps we should go for a walk, he said.
I'm not so sure.
If we should take a walk?
The man plainly did not know what to say. He mumbled something about the men's toilet and hurried off. The excuse was not in the least convincing as he took out his mobile before he was even out of sight. That was when Blomqvist became convinced that he had guessed right. He texted Salander that Leo was almost certainly Daniel. As he continued to wait, he became increasingly worried that he had been outwitted, that the man had escaped through a back door. The minutes went by and nothing happened. Employees and visitors came and went. The young woman at reception smiled and wished everyone a good day. It was a stylish place, with high ceilings and red-patterned wallpaper, oil paintings of elderly gentlemen in suits, presumably one-time partners or board members, hung on the walls. In this day and age, the lack of women was an obscenity. Blomqvist's mobile buzzed. It was Giannini, and he was about to take the call when the man, Leo or Daniel, came back down the corridor. He seemed to have pulled himself together. Perhaps he had made some sort of decision. It was hard to tell. His throat was flushed, and he looked tense and serious. His eyes were fixed on the floor, and he said nothing to Blomqvist, just told the receptionist that he would be gone for a few hours. They took the lift down and stepped out onto Norrmalmstorg. Stockholm was ferociously hot. People were fanning themselves with newspapers, with anything. Men had slung their jackets over their shoulders. They turned into Hamngatan, and Blomqvist noticed the man look nervously behind him. He briefly wondered whether to suggest that they hop on a bus or take a taxi. Instead, they crossed the street onto Kungsträdgården. They walked on in silence, as if they were waiting for something to happen. The man was sweating more than he ought to have been, even in this heat, and again glanced around anxiously. They found themselves diagonally across from Operan, and although he could not put his finger on why, Blomqvist sensed a threat. Maybe he had made a mistake, and the people from the registry could already be a step ahead of him. He turned around. Nothing. In fact, the streets were peaceful. There was a holiday feeling in the air. People sat on park benches and on café terraces, their faces towards the sun. Perhaps his companion's nervousness was rubbing off on him. He went straight to the point.
So, shall I call you Leo or Daniel?
The man bit his lip, and a shadow came over his face. A second later he threw himself on top of Blomqvist, and together they crashed to the ground. Greitz, who had been waiting on a bench on Norman's story, had seen Daniel Brolin walk away with Blomqvist. She understood that elements had been set in motion which would lead to the story leaking out, sooner rather than later. She was neither surprised nor shocked. She had known for some time that the stakes were high, but instead of eliciting mere despair, this allowed her also a kind of freedom. She appeared to have acquired the resolve of someone who has nothing to lose. Plus, she had Benjamin. He was not dying as she was, but he was bound to her by his lifelong loyalty, and by the unspeakable things they had done together. If it all came out, his fall would be as great as hers. Without questioning it, he had agreed to put Blomqvist out of action and take Daniel to a place where they could talk sense into him. This was why Benjamin, in spite of the heat, was wearing a black hoodie and dark glasses. He was carrying a concealed syringe filled with ketamine, an anesthetic which would knock the journalist clean out. Although she had been suffering from stomach pains all morning, Greitz had dragged herself over to the avenue running alongside Kungsträdgården. In the glaring sunlight she made out Benjamin moving along with quick steps. Her senses sharpened. The city became one single concentrated moment, one sparkling scene, and she watched intently as Daniel and Blomqvist slowed and the journalist appeared to be asking a question. Good, she thought, that will distract them, and in that moment she believed it would go precisely as planned. Further down the street a horse-drawn carriage appeared. A blue hot-air balloon hung in the sky, and people were walking by in every direction, oblivious to what was going on. Her heart pounded in anticipation, and she was breathing deeply. But then Daniel looked up, saw Benjamin, and threw Blomqvist to the ground. The journalist lay flat on the pavement, and Benjamin hesitated and missed his chance. Blomqvist jumped to his feet. Benjamin lunged at him, but the journalist dodged him, and then Benjamin took to his heels. The coward! Furious, she watched as Daniel and Blomqvist ran towards Operakälaren. They jumped into a taxi and were gone. The heat settled like a wet blanket over Greitz, and she felt only how unwell and nauseous she was. Yet she managed to pull herself up to her full height, and as rapidly as she was able, she left the scene. Salander was lying pressed against the floor of the grey van, being kicked at intervals in the stomach and face. The noxious rag was again placed over her nose, and she felt woozy and weak as she went in and out of consciousness. She had no trouble recognizing Benito and Bashir, no happy combination. Benito was looking pale and was bandaged around her head and jaw. She was having difficulty moving, so she kept still, which was good. Most of the blows aimed at Salander came from the men. Bashir, bearded and sweaty, dressed in the same clothes as the day before, and a thick-set man of about 35 with a shaved head, grey T-shirt and black leather vest. A third man was driving. The van rolled down past Slusen. At least she thought so. She tried to register every detail in the vehicle, a coil of rope, a roll of tape, two screwdrivers. Another kick, this time to her neck. Someone grabbed her hands. They tied her up, frisked her, and took her mobile. That was a worry, but the bald guy stuffed it into his pocket, and that was fine. She made a note of his physique and jerky movements, and his tendency to keep looking at Benito. He was obviously Benito's lapdog, not Bashir's. There was a bench on the left side of the van. They sat there while she lay on the floor, amid the smell of perfume, the stench of rubbing alcohol and sweat from their sneakers. Salander thought they were heading north, but she could not be sure. She was far too light-headed. For a long time no one spoke. The only sounds were of people breathing and engine noise and the metallic rattling of the old van. It must have been at least 30 years old. They drove out onto a main road and after 20 minutes or so began to talk. That was good. That was what she needed. Bashir had a bruise on his throat, from her blow with the hockey stick, she hoped. He looked like he had slept badly. In fact, he looked like shit.
"You have no idea how we're going to make you suffer, you little whore," he said.
Salander was silent.
"Then I'm going to kill you, slowly, with my keris," Benito said.
Still Salander said nothing. Why would she, when she knew that every word spoken was being transmitted to a number of different computers? Nothing too sophisticated, at least not by her standards. When they overpowered her in the street, she had whispered "Harpy" into her modified iPhone. That had activated her alarm button via SRI's AI system, and a boosted microphone was switched on automatically, triggering a sound recording that was sent to all members of the so-called Hacker Republic, together with the mobile's GPS coordinates. Hacker Republic consisted of a group of elite hackers, all of whom had sworn a solemn oath to use the alarm only in cases of dire emergency. As a consequence, a number of talented people all around the world were now breathlessly following the dramatic events in the back of the van. Most did not understand Swedish, but enough did, including Salander's friend on Höglingtavägen in Sundbyberg. Plague was as wide as a house, at £330, but stooped from spending all day at his keyboard. His beard was a thicket, and he hadn't had a haircut since the previous year. He looked like a case for social welfare, but he was an IT genius. He was sitting by his computer in his frayed blue dressing gown, nerves on high alert, following the GPS coordinates northwards towards Uppsala. The car, it sounded large and old, turned east onto National Highway 77 towards Knivsta. And that was not good. They were heading further out into the countryside, where GPS coverage was patchy at best. He heard the woman in the vehicle again, her voice hoarse and weak, as if she were unwell.
"Do you have any idea how slowly you're going to die, you bitch? Do you?"
Plague looked at his desk in desperation. It was strewn with scraps of paper, used coffee cups and greasy styrofoam containers. His back hurt. He had gained weight, which did not help his diabetes, and it was almost a week since he had last been out of the house. What was he to do? If he had an address for their destination, he could hack the electricity and water utilities, locate neighbours, and organise a group of local vigilantes, but he had no idea where they were heading. He was powerless. His whole body shook and his heart pounded. Messages came pouring in. Salander was their friend, their shining star. But as far as Plague could tell, nobody in the Fellowship had any good suggestions, at least nothing which could be organised fast enough. Should he call the police? Plague had never contacted the authorities, for good reason. There were few cybercrimes he had not committed. In one way or another, they were always after him. And yet, he thought, and yet, even the outlaw has to turn to the law for help sometimes. He remembered Salander, or Wasp, as he knew her, had once talked about an Inspector Bublansky. He was okay, she had said, and coming from her, okay was a major compliment. For a minute, Plague sat paralysed, staring at a map of Uppland on his computer screen. Then he plugged in his headphones and turned up the volume on the audio file. He wanted to hear every subtle variation in the voices, even in the engine noise. There was a buzzing and scraping in his ears. For a short while nobody spoke, then somebody said what Plague least wanted to hear.
"Have you got her phone?"
It was the woman again. She may have sounded terrible, but she seemed to be in charge, she and the man who sometimes spoke to the driver in a language the hackers had uploaded and now identified as Bengali.
"It's in my pocket," one of the men answered. "Give it to me."
There was a rustling and a crackling as the mobile was passed around. Somebody pressed some keys, turned it over, breathed into it.
"Is there anything fishy about it?" "I don't know," the woman answered. "Doesn't look like it. But maybe the police can use this piece of crap to listen in."
"We'd better get rid of it." Plague heard some more words in Bengali, and the car seemed to slow. A door creaked open, even though the vehicle was still moving. Wind sounded in the microphone, and then there was a swishing sound, followed by a clattering and an excruciatingly loud bang. Plague ripped off his headphones and slammed his fist on the table.
"Shit! Damn fuck!"
Expletives flooded in over the network. They had lost contact with Wasp. Plague tried to visualize the situation. Traffic cameras.
Of course. Why hadn't he thought of that?
But they'd have to hack the Transport Administration to get access to their cameras, and that took time, and time they did not have. He wrote,
"Does anyone know how to get into the Transport Administration system quickly? Like, now?"
He hooked them all up to an encrypted audio link.
"Some CCTV footage is publicly available online," somebody said. "That's too jerky and blurred," he said. "We've got to get close enough to see the model of the car in the reg plates."
"I know a shortcut." It was a young female voice. It took Plague a moment to identify her. Nellie, one of their new members.
"Really?" he exclaimed. "Great. Get in there. Hook yourselves up to her. Go for it. Give it everything you've got. I'll give you the times and coordinates."
Plague went onto the site, www.trafiken.nu, which showed the location of cameras along the E4 motorway to Uppsala, and at the same time rewound the file from Wasp's mobile. The alarm had been activated at 12:52 p.m. The first camera on that route was likely to be the one at Hargis South, and, wait a moment, the vehicle seemed to have passed by there about 13 minutes later, at 1:05 p.m. Then the cameras came in quick succession. That was good, he thought. Good. Linvevar Torpet, and Linvevar Torpet South, then Linvevar Torpet North, and Haga North Gates, Haga North, Stora Frusunda, Järva Krog, Mellenjärva, Ulriksdal's Golf Course. There were plenty of cameras along the first stretch, and even though there was heavy traffic, they should be able to identify the vehicle, since it was obviously an older, bigger model, a van or a light truck.
"How's it going?" he shouted. "Just chill, man, we're working on it. Someone's really been messing with this. They put in something new. Hell, access denied. Wait, shit. Fuck, yes! Now, yes, we're running, we're in. Now we just need to get... What kind of idiots built this amateur shit?"
It was the usual. Swearing and shouting. Adrenaline and sweat and more yelling, only this time it was worse. It was a matter of life and death. And once they had figured out the system and how to get in and had gone back and forth on the surveillance cameras, they identified the car, an old grey Mercedes minivan with apparently fake number plates. But now what? They felt even more powerless as the vehicle passed one camera position after the next like a pale, evil spirit, and in the end disappeared beyond the reach of surveillance into the forests to the east of Knivsta, somewhere near the lake at Vadabo.
Digital darkness. Shit. Shit!
Never before had there been so much shouting and swearing among Hacker Republic. Plague saw no alternative but to call Chief Inspector Bublansky. Chapter 21 June 22nd. Bublansky was sitting in his office on Bergsgatan, talking to Imam Hassan Ferdusi. By now he understood how Jamal Chowdhury's murder had come about. The whole Qazi family, apart from the father, had been involved, along with some Islamists in exile from Bangladesh. It was a somewhat sophisticated operation, but no more so than the initial crime investigation should have been able to unravel without third-party help. For the police, it was nothing short of a disgrace. Bublansky had just had a conversation with the chief of SEPO, Helena Kraft, and was now discussing with the imam how the police could do better at anticipating and preventing violent crimes like these in the future. But his mind was really elsewhere. He wanted to get back to the investigation into Holger Palmgren's death, and especially look into this Professor Steinberg.
What was that again?
The imam had said something which Bublansky did not fully understand, but before he could inquire further, his telephone rang with a Skype call from a user who called himself "Total Fucking Shitstorm for Salander." And that in itself was pretty weird. Who would call themselves that? Bublansky answered his mobile, and at the end of the line was a young man shouting at him in rather graphic Swedish.
"I'm not going to listen to a single word you say until you've introduced yourself," Bublansky said. "My name is Plague. Switch on your computer and open the link I've sent you, and then I'll explain."
Bublansky hesitated at first, but he kept listening to the man, who was using swear words liberally interspersed with incomprehensible computer terminology, but who nonetheless was precise and clear in what he had to report. Bublansky was finally persuaded to open the link, and overcoming his confusion and his scepticism, he sprang into action. He mobilized a helicopter and patrol cars from both Stockholm and Uppsala to head for Vardaborsu. Then he and Amanda Flod ran down to his Volvo in the garage. He decided it would be safer to have her drive as they sped northwards to Uppsala, blue lights flashing. The man next to him had saved him from a serious assault. Blomqvist was still not certain he understood why. But it had to be a good sign. They were no longer in the same opposing roles of investigative reporter and quarry as they had been back in the Alfred Ugren lobby. There was a shared bond between them, and Blomqvist was now in his debt. The sun was beating down outside. They were in a small top-floor apartment on Towersgatan, with attic windows looking out over Riddarfjorden. A half-finished oil painting of an ocean and a white whale was propped on an easel. There was harmony in the painting, despite an unconventional combination of colours. But Blomqvist turned it to face the windows. He did not want any distractions. The apartment belonged to Irene Vestervik, an elderly artist who Blomqvist knew only a little. But he felt a certain fondness for her. She was wise and inspired confidence and lived at a remove from the endless churn of current affairs. Sometimes she enabled him to look at the world from a broader perspective. He had called her from the taxi to ask if he might borrow her studio for a few hours, perhaps for the rest of the day. She had met them in a pale green dress at the street entrance and had handed over the keys with a gentle smile. Now Blomkvist and the man, who was presumably Daniel, were sitting in the apartment facing each other. To be on the safe side, their mobiles were switched off, and they had put them on a shelf in the galley kitchen. It was sweltering beneath the roof, and Blomkvist had tried and failed to open the studio windows.
"Was that a syringe in that man's hand?"
"Looked like it.
I wonder what was in it."
"In the worst case, synthetic curare."
"Poison?"
"Yes. A heavy dose knocks out everything, including the respiratory muscles. You suffocate."
"You seem to know all about it," Blomkvist said.
The man looked sorrowful, and Blomkvist's gaze turned to the window and the blue sky.
"Can I call you Daniel?" he said.
The man was silent. He hesitated.
"It's Dan," he said. "I got a green card, became an American citizen, and changed my name. Now I go by Dan Brody."
"Or Leo Mannheimer."
"Yes, that's true." "A bit peculiar, wouldn't you say?"
"Indeed."
"Do you want to tell me the story, Dan? We've got plenty of time.
No one will come looking for us here."
"Is there anything stronger to drink?"
"Let me look in the fridge." Blomkvist found several bottles of white wine, a Sancerre.
"This is my new normal," he thought bleakly, "drinking through interviews."
He helped himself to a bottle and found two glasses.
"Here," he said, filling them up. "I don't really know where to begin. You said you'd met Hilda. Did she talk about—"
Again Dan hesitated, as if reluctant to mention a name or an event that filled him with fear.
"About what?"
"Raquel Greitz."
"Hilda told me a lot about her."
Dan just raised his glass and drank, grim and resolute. Then slowly he began to tell his story. It began at a jazz club in Berlin, with a guitar solo and a woman who could not take her eyes off him. They had driven into a forest and stopped. The inside of the van was unbearably stuffy, and all that could be heard from outside was the sound of birds and insects. The engine idled. Salando was thirsty, and she felt sick from the chloroform, or maybe from the beating. She was still lying on the floor, tied up, but when she got to her knees nobody objected, although they glared at her the whole time. The engine was switched off, and those on the bench nodded at each other. Benito drank some water to wash down a few tablets. She was ashen-faced and did not move as Bashir and the other man stood up. Zalander could now see the man's tattooed forearms and the emblem on his leather vest, Svavrische MC, the same motorcycle gang which had been allied with her father and her sister. Had Camilla and her hackers cracked Zalander's address? Zalander studied the back door of the van and tried to recall the action with which it had been opened when her mobile was thrown into the road. With mathematical precision, she recalled the force in the movement, or rather, the lack of it. She could not remove the rope around her hands, but she should be able to kick open the door. That was good. As was Benito's head injury, and how jittery the men seemed. Bashir grimaced, just as he had in Valholmen, and drew back his right foot to kick her. She absorbed it, overreacting a little. Not that she needed to. It was a violent kick which caught her in the ribs. Then she took another one in the face and feigned being dazed, but all the while she was watching Benito. From the outset, Zalander had had a feeling that this was first and foremost Benito's show. She would have the last word. Now she was bending over her grey canvas bag on the floor and taking out a red velvet cloth. The men seized Zalander roughly by the shoulders. This did not bode well, especially when Benito pulled a dagger from the bag. Her keris. It was straight and shiny, and it looked very sharp with a long gold-tipped blade. The handle had been carved to represent a demon with slanting eyes. It was the kind of weapon that should have been in a museum, not in the hands of an ashen-faced psychopath with a bandaged head, who was now examining the knife with a demented tenderness. In a reedy voice, Benito explained how the keris was to be used. Zalander did not listen attentively. It didn't seem necessary, but she heard enough. The keris would be stabbed through the red cloth, just beneath the collarbone, straight into the heart. The blood would be wiped off onto the cloth on its way out. It was said to require extraordinary skill. Salander went on making a careful inventory of everything in the van, every object, every accumulation of dust, every moment of faltering concentration. She glanced up at Bashir. He gripped her left shoulder and looked determined and tense. She was going to die, and he was fine with that. But he didn't look especially pleased, and it was plain to see why. Essentially, he was the helper of a woman. And that can't have been easy for someone who thought of women as no more than whores or second-class citizens.
"Do you know your Koran?" Salander said.
She could tell right away by his grip on her shoulder that her question had unsettled him. She went on to say that the Prophet had condemned all types of kerises. They belonged to Satan and the demons. And then she quoted a surah, one she had invented. She gave it a number and urged him to look it up.
"Check it out and you'll see."
But Benito stood up with her dagger and said,
"She's full of shit. The keris didn't even exist at the time of Muhammad. Now it's a weapon for holy warriors the world over."
Bashir seemed to believe her. Or at least he wanted to believe her.
"Okay, okay, get a move on," he said,
adding something in Bengali for the benefit of the driver up front. Suddenly Benito seemed to be in a hurry, even as she was overcome by dizziness and lurched to one side. There was a sound high above them, the reverberations of a helicopter. Though it might not have had anything to do with them, Salander knew that her friends at Hacker Republic were unlikely to have been sitting around doing nothing. The noise was both promising, because help might soon be at hand, and worrying, because of the increased activity in the van. Bashir and the other man were gripping her tightly as Benito advanced towards her, looking determined with her long dagger and red cloth. Salander thought of Palmgren. She thought of her mother and the dragon in Storkirken, and she braced herself against the floor. Come what may, she had to get to her feet. Dan sat in silence. He had reached a painful point in the story. His eyes flickered about and his hands shifted nervously.
"When Rackel said she would have me convicted for murdering my brother unless I cooperated, I felt helpless. I hardly knew what was happening. They made me wear sunglasses and a hat. It would be dangerous for there to be two Leos in the stairwell," she said. "We had to get him out of the apartment while he could still stand. I saw an opportunity. If we could only get out, I thought, I'd be able to shout for help."
"But you didn't."
"We didn't meet anybody in the elevator or on the stairs. It was the day before Christmas Eve. Raquel's sidekick, I don't think John is his real name, in fact, she called him Benjamin several times, it was the man who attacked you this morning. Anyway, he—" Dan paused and took a deep breath. "He dragged Leo, who could only just stay upright, to a black Renault van parked outside. It was getting dark, or at least that's how it felt," he said, and he fell silent again.
December, 1.5 years earlier. Dan looked at the empty street before him, as weird as if he were in a stone-bordered, desolate nightmare. He might have run away to call for help, but how could he abandon his brother? It would have been impossible. They pushed Leo into the car, and Dan asked,
"We're taking him to the hospital now, right?"
"Yes," Greitz said. Did he believe her? She had just said there was no point and had threatened him. He clambered into the car and focused on one thing. Before she took his mobile, he had managed to read online that a patient can recover from curare poisoning as long as respiration is maintained. He sat down next to Leo in the back seat. On the other side of him was the man Greitz called Benjamin. Dan was concentrating on trying to help Leo breathe. Again, he asked if they really were on their way to a hospital. Greitz, who was driving, was more specific this time. They were headed to the Karolinska hospital, and she even named the department.
"Trust me," she said.
She claimed to have called ahead to warn specialists who were preparing to receive Leo. Maybe Dan knew it was all nonsense. Maybe he was too shocked to absorb what was happening. It was hard to remember anything at all. He focused solely on keeping Leo's breathing going. And nobody stopped him. That was something to be grateful for. Greitz drove fast. There was not much traffic, and they came up onto Solnabron. The red hospital buildings seemed to rise like an apparition in the darkness, and for an instant he thought it might all be okay, in the end. But it was no more than a smoke screen, an attempt to keep him quiet for a while. Instead of stopping, the car accelerated past the hospital, driving northwards towards Solna. He must have been shouting and lashing out because there was a sudden burning sensation in his thigh, and he felt his protests grow weaker, less forceful. The rage and desperation did not leave him, but he felt his strength ebbing away. He shook his head and blinked. He strove to think clearly, to keep Leo alive, but he was struggling for words and finding it hard to move, and far away, as if through a fog, he could hear Greitz and the man whispering to each other. He lost track of time. At some point Greitz raised her voice. She was speaking to him now, and there was something hypnotic about her tone. What was she saying? She talked about everything he would get, about dreams fulfilled, about wealth, happiness. With Leo gasping for breath beside him, the massive figure of Benjamin on the other side, Greitz sitting in the front, talking about happiness and riches, it was impossible to describe. It was beyond words. Blomqvist might not ever be able to grasp it, but Dan had to try. There was no other way.
"Were you tempted?" Blomqvist asked.
The wine bottle was standing on the white coffee table, and Dan felt an impulse to smash it over the journalist's head.
"You've got to understand," he said, trying hard to sound calm. "At that moment, I couldn't imagine my life without Leo."
He was quiet again.
"What was going through your mind?"
"Only one thing. How we would make it through this."
"And what was your plan?"
"My plan? I don't know. I guess I thought I'd play along and hope a way out would present itself. As we drove further and further into the countryside, I managed to regain some of my strength. I was looking at Leo the whole time. He got worse. He began to cramp again. He couldn't move. Sorry. It's hard for me to talk about it."
"Take your time."
Dan reached for his wine glass and went on.
"I had no idea where we were. The road was getting narrower. We were in a pine forest. Darkness had fallen and the snow had turned to rain. I saw a signpost. Vidokra, it said. We headed to the right onto a forest track, and after 10 minutes Rackle stopped the car and Benjamin got out. He took something out of the trunk and there was an unpleasant rattling noise. I didn't want to know what it was. I was busy looking after Leo. I opened the door, laid him across the seat, and started CPR. I had only a vague idea of what I was doing, but I tried. I've never tried so hard at anything in my whole life. I was dizzy, and Leo had vomited without my even noticing it. There was a foul smell in the car. I felt like I was leaning over myself. Can you understand that? As if I was giving breath to my own dying self. And the strange thing is that they let me keep at it. They were gentle with me now, Rackel and this guy, Benjamin. It was odd, and I didn't really understand what was going on. Rackel said in a soft voice that Leo was going to die. Soon the effect of the physostigmine would leave him, and nothing could be done. It was horrible, she said. But the good thing was that nobody would be looking for him. No one would even wonder where he went, as long as I took his place. His mother was dying, she said, and I could resign from Alfred Ogren and sell my interest in the company to Ivar. No one would be surprised. They'd all known for ages that Leo's dream was to leave the company. It was as if the scene was set for divine justice. I would get what I had always deserved. I humored them. I saw no alternative. I mumbled, I hemmed and hawed. They'd taken my phone, I think I told you, and I was miles away in a forest, and I couldn't see lights from a single house. Benjamin came back looking like a complete mess, soaked through with sweat and rain, muddy snow on his trousers. His woolen hat was askew. He didn't say a word. A nasty, unspoken complicity hung in the air as Benjamin dragged Leo out of the back seat. Leo's head hit the ground, and I bent down to help. I pulled off Benjamin's hat, I remember, and put it on Leo. Then I buttoned up his coat. We hadn't even dressed him warmly. He had no scarf, and he was wearing his indoor shoes, and they were untied, laces dangling. It was a scene from hell, and I wondered if I should run off to get help. Just take off, into the forest, or along the track, and hope to find somebody. But was there time for that? I didn't think so. I wasn't even sure Leo was still alive. So I followed into the trees. Benjamin was dragging Leo along clumsily, and I offered to help. Benjamin didn't like that. He wanted to get me away from there. "Go," he said. "Get lost. This isn't anything for you." And he yelled for Rackel, but I don't think she heard. The wind was blowing hard, rustling the trees. We were being scratched by bushes and branches, and then we arrived at a large, diseased-looking pine, next to which was a pile of stones and earth. There was a shovel lying nearby, and for a moment I thought,
I wanted to believe that we had stumbled on some sort of excavation which had nothing to do with us.
But it was a grave.
It was an attempt at a grave, not a very deep one. Benjamin must have had a hell of a time digging into that frozen earth. He looked exhausted as he put Leo on the ground and shouted at me to go away. I told him that I had to say goodbye, that he was a heartless bastard. He threatened me again, saying that Grice had enough evidence to have me put away for murder. "He's my twin brother, for Christ's sake. Show a little consideration. Leave me in peace. I'll bury him myself. I won't run away. And Leo's dead anyway. Look at him!" I yelled. "Look at him!" Well, then he really did leave me. I suspected that he hadn't gone far. But he did walk out of sight, and I was alone with Leo. I crouched on my heels under the pine tree and leaned over him, Dan said.
Janini had eaten her lunch in the staff canteen at Claudebury, and was back in the visitors' section in H block to take part in the continuation of Harry's questioning, which Murdoch was leading. In the afternoon session, Murdoch was proving to be capable and efficient. She agreed with Janini that it was important not only to establish the facts of the long-standing oppression Faria had suffered, but also to do what they could, after all this time, to investigate whether her attack on her brother might be a case of assault and manslaughter rather than murder. Had she really intended to kill him? Janini was optimistic. She had gotten Faria to summon up every possible aspect of her frame of mind at the time of the attack, but then Murdoch got a call, which she had taken in the corridor. When she returned, she was no longer her cool and collected self. This shift of mood vexed Janini.
"For God's sake, don't try that poker face on me. I can tell that something serious has happened. Spit it out, now!"
"I know, and I'm sorry. I couldn't bring myself to tell you," Murdoch said. "Bashir Kazi and Benito have abducted Lisbon. We have the whole team working on it, but it's not looking good."
"Tell me everything," Janini said.
Murdoch told her, and Janini shuddered. Faria shrank back into her chair, her arms folded around her legs. But then something shifted in her. Janini was the first to notice it. Faria's eyes were not only filled with fear and rage, there was something else there, deep and intense.
"Did you say Vada Borshu?"
"Yes. The last sighting of them is from a surveillance camera. The van swung onto a forest track heading towards the area around the lake," Murdoch said.
"We—"
"Yes, what is it?" Janini said.
"Before we could afford to go to Mallorca, my family used to camp at Vada Borshu," Faria said. "We went often. It's not far, so we could decide at the last moment to go there for the weekend. That was when our mother was still alive. Vada Borshu is surrounded by thick forest, you know, and it's full of narrow paths and hiding places. There was one time—"
Faria hesitated, holding on to her knees.
"Have you got a signal on your phone? If you can pull up a detailed map of the area, I'll try to explain."
Murdoch searched and muttered and searched again, and eventually she brightened. The Uppsala police had downloaded a map for them.
"Show me,"
Faria said, a new tone to her voice.
"They drove in here,"
Murdoch said, showing her the map on her screen.
"Wait just a moment," Faria said. "Let me try to get my bearings. There's something called Sudraviken somewhere around the lake, isn't there? Or Sudraviken, Sudra Stranden?
Let me take a look."
Murdoch keyed Sudra into the search engine.
"Could it be Sudra Strandviken?" she said.
"That's it, yes, that must be it," Faria said eagerly. "Let me see now. There's a small bumpy track, but still wide enough for a car. Could that be it?" she said, zooming in. "I'm not sure. But at the time there was a yellow sign where you drove in. End of public road, it said. A little way down the track, a little more than a mile along, there's a sort of cave. Not a real cave, more like a sheltered space in the midst of a large clump of trees with thick foliage. It's at the top of a hill on the left, and you have to pass through a whole curtain of leaves, but then you come out in a completely secluded spot, surrounded by bushes and trees. You can see a ravine and a brook through a gap in the vegetation. Bashir took me there once, and I thought he wanted to show me something exciting, but it was to frighten me. It was when my body was starting to fill out a bit, and some guys on the beach had whistled at me. When we arrived, he told me a whole load of rubbish about how in the old days they used to take women there who had behaved like whores to punish them. He scared me out of my wits, and that's why I remember it.
Now I'm wondering if Bashir took Lisbeth to that place. Modig nodded gravely and thanked her. She took back her mobile and made a call. Boblansky was getting reports from Sami Hamid, one of the police helicopter pilots. Hamid was circling Vardaboshur and the surrounding woodland at low altitude, but had seen no sign of a grey van, nor had the walkers, the campers, or any of the policemen patrolling the area. It wasn't easy, admittedly. The lake was bordered by wide-open beaches, but the surrounding forest was dense and a jumble of labyrinthine paths crisscrossed the terrain. It seemed an ideal place to hide, and that worried Boblansky. He had not cursed so much in a long time, and he kept egging Flod on to drive faster. They were thundering along National Highway 77 and still had some way to go before they reached the lake. Thanks to voice identification, they knew it was Benito and Bashir Kazi whom they were pursuing, which meant the threat to Salander was critical. Boblansky did not waste a second. He was onto the coordinators at Uppsala police every few minutes and rang every conceivable person he could think of who might provide information. He rang Blomqvist several times, but the journalist had switched off his mobile. Boblansky swore and prayed by turns. Although he and Salander were hardly on friendly terms, he felt a fatherly affection for her, not least because she had given them the means to solve a serious crime. He asked Flod to pick up the pace. They were getting closer to the woods around the lake. His mobile rang. It was Modig, telling him to key Södra Strandviken into the car's GPS, and then she passed her mobile to Faria Kazi. He couldn't understand why he should be talking to her, but in fact the woman sounded quite different. She spoke with a fierce determination and with perfect clarity. Boblansky listened carefully and intently and hoped it would not be too late. Just up ahead, they saw a yellow sign that marked a turnoff into the forest.
Chapter 22 June 22nd. Salander had no idea where she was. It was hot, and she could hear flies and mosquitoes, wind rustling in the trees and bushes, and water babbling softly. She focused on her legs. They were skinny and did not look like much, but they were strong. Right now they were the only thing she had to defend herself with. She was kneeling in the van, her hands tied. Benita was grimacing in her bandages, the dagger and the cloth shaking in her hands. She really did look like death. Salander glanced at the door of the van. The men held her down by the shoulders and shouted at her. She looked up to see Bashir's face shining with sweat. He glared as if he wanted to punch her. Salander asked herself if she might be able to play them off against each other. Time was running out. Benita was standing in front of her now, an evil queen with her long dagger, and the mood inside the van was changing. It became solemn and still, as if something momentous was about to happen. One of the men ripped Salander's T-shirt to expose her collarbone. She looked at Benito. Her red lipstick cut a slash across her ash-grey skin. But she seemed to be steadier on her feet now, as if the horror of the moment had sharpened her senses. In a voice which fell one octave, she said,
"Hold her still. Good, good. This is immense. This is the moment of her death. Can you feel my keris pointed at you? You're going to suffer now. You're going to die."
Benito peered into Salander's face and smiled with eyes which were beyond all mercy and humanity. For a second or so, all Salander could see was the blade of the dagger held out towards her exposed chest. A split second later, a flood of impressions washed over her. She saw Benito had 3 safety pins in her bandage. She saw that her right pupil was larger than the left, and she saw there was a sign from Bagarmorsan Animal Hospital just inside the van door. She saw 3 yellow paper clips, and a dog leash on the floor, and a line drawn with blue felt tip on the inside of the van above her. But most of all, she saw the red velvet cloth. Benita was not comfortable holding it. However self-confident she might be with the dagger, the cloth was a foreign object, nothing more than ritual mumbo-jumbo. She did not seem to know what to do with it, and suddenly she threw it onto the floor. Salander braced herself with her toes. Bashir yelled at her to stay still, and she heard nervousness in his voice. She saw Benito blink and the dagger being raised to home in on the point just below her collarbone. She prepared herself by stiffening the muscles in her body and wondered if survival was even possible. She was on her knees, her hands bound, and the men were holding her tight. She closed her eyes and pretended to have resigned herself to her fate while she listened to the silence and the breathing in the back of the van. She felt excitement in the air, the thirst for blood, and also fear, a kind of pleasure mixed with terror. Even in this company, an execution was a serious undertaking. And what was that? It was far away and hard to make out, but it sounded like engine noise, not from a single car, but from several. At that very moment, Benito made her move, and then it was time. Zalanda flew up in an explosive burst of energy. She scrambled to her feet, but she did not escape the dagger. Flood braked so sharply that the car skidded, and she looked angrily at Bublansky as if it was his fault. The chief inspector was oblivious. He was on the line to Faria and called out, "We found the sign! I see it!" he cursed under his breath as the car swerved and shook. The yellow sign did indeed say, "End of public road." Flood controlled the skid and turned into the track, a swamp of mud with deep ruts. The rain, which had fallen relentlessly before the heat wave took the country in its grip, had made it almost impassable, and the car slipped and bumped. "Slow down, for God's sake! We can't afford to miss it!" Bublansky yelled. According to Faria, the place was at the top of a rise hidden behind a kind of screen of branches and foliage. Bublansky could see no sign of any rising ground. Looking at the density of the trees all around, he did not think they had much of a chance of finding the van. It could be hidden anywhere in this forest. It might even be on its way to some different place. He tried to calculate the length of time that had passed since the van was last sighted. And above all, how could the girl be so sure where the clearing was? How could she remember so many details or have the least clear idea of distances after so many years? The forest looked the same to him on all sides. Nowhere were there any distinguishing features. He was about to give up. The trees were closing in overhead so that it was practically dark. Uppsala sent word that other police vehicles were behind them. That would be helpful, if indeed they were on the right track. He felt sure the forest would be able to camouflage an entire fleet of vans or trucks, but he did not see how they would be able to find anything in this impenetrable jungle. He racked his brains as Flood negotiated the mud bath. Then, over there. It was not a hill exactly, but still a definite slope. Flood accelerated gently. The wheels spun, and the car approached the top of the rise. Bublansky continued to describe what he was seeing. There was a large, globe-shaped stone by the side of the track, which Faria might remember, but she did not. Damn it, they were getting nowhere. And then he heard a bang, something striking tin or sheet metal, and he heard shouting, agitated voices. He put his hand on Flood's arm and she hit the brakes. He drew his service revolver and jumped out, flinging himself into the forest, under branches and through bushes, and in a dizzying instant he realized that they really had found the place. December, 1.5 years earlier. Dan Brody was kneeling in the wet snow in another forest at another time of year, under that pine tree not far from Vidukra village, staring down at Leo as his face turned blue, the life draining out of his blue eyes. It was a moment of pure horror, but it cannot have lasted long. Dan restarted the artificial respiration right away, though Leo's lips were as cold as the snow beneath him, and his lungs were not responding, and Dan thought he could hear footsteps returning. Soon he would have to head back to the car. There's only half a person. "Wake up, Leo! Wake up!" he muttered over and over, like a mantra, a prayer. He no longer had any faith in his plan, or in his ability to revive his brother. Benjamin had to be close, maybe even spying on him in the darkness through a gap in the trees. He must have been nervous and impatient, desperate to bury Leo and get the hell out of there. The situation was hopeless, but Dan kept going, ever more desperate. He pinched Leo's nose shut and breathed into his airways with such force and violence that he grew dizzy. He hardly knew what he was doing. He remembered hearing a car far off, a distant engine. There was a rustling in the forest, the sound of a startled animal. Some birds flew up with a loud flapping, and then the silence returned, a frightening silence. He felt as if his very life had drained away. He needed to take a break. He had run out of breath and was coughing. It was a second or two before he realized that something strange was happening. His coughing seemed to reverberate and echo from the ground. Then it dawned on him that it was Leo. He, too, was panting and struggling. Dan could hardly believe it. He just stared at Leo and felt... What did he feel? Not happiness. Just urgency.
Leo, he whispered, they're going to kill you. You've got to run further into the forest. Get up! Go! Now!
Leo struggled to understand. He was fighting for air and trying to get his bearings. Dan pulled him up and shoved him into the bushes. Leo fell badly, but staggered to his feet and stumbled away. Dan did not watch him go. He began to fill in the hole with a ferocious energy, and then he heard what he had anticipated for some time, Benjamin's footsteps. He looked down into the shallow grave, sure he would be found out, and his digging became even more frenzied. He shoveled and cursed, throwing himself into the work, and now he could hear Benjamin breathing. He heard his trouser legs rustling and his feet crunching against the wet snow. He expected Benjamin to lunge at him or to start chasing after Leo, but the man said nothing. Another car could be heard far off in the distance. More birds took to the air.
I couldn't bear to look at him, Dan said.
He thought the words rang hollow, and when Benjamin did not respond, he prepared for the worst and closed his eyes. Benjamin came closer. He smelled of tobacco.
I'll help you, he said.
They shoveled and pushed the rest of the earth into the empty grave and carefully replaced the turf and stones. Then they walked slowly to the car, their heads bowed. On the way back to Stockholm, Dan sat quietly, grimly listening to Greitz's plans. Salander shot up like a cannonball and was stabbed in the side. She had no idea how serious her injury was, nor did she have time to worry about it. Benito had lost her balance and was now stabbing wildly at thin air with her dagger. Salander stepped smartly to one side, head-butted her, and sprang to the van door. She opened it with her body and jumped down onto the grass with her hands bound, adrenaline pumping through her veins. She landed on her feet, but with such a force that she fell forward and rolled down a short, steep slope to a small brook. She just had time to see the water begin to turn blood red before she scrambled to her feet and ran into the forest. She heard the sound of cars pulling up, voices raised, doors slamming. She did not think to stop. She needed only to get away. Oblansky did not see Salander through the leaves, but he spotted two men making their way down a steep slope. Up above them stood a grey van facing into the foliage. He yelled, "Stop! Police! Nobody move!" and pointed his service revolver at them. It was unbearably hot and humid in the clearing, and his body felt heavy. He was panting. The men he was confronting were both younger and stronger, and no doubt more ruthless, too. But as he looked around and listened out in the direction of the track they had come along, he still felt the situation was under control. Flood was standing nearby in the same stance. The police teams sent by Uppsala must be very close by now. The men were unarmed and had been caught unawares.
"Don't do anything stupid now," he said. "You're surrounded. Where's Salander?"
The men said nothing. They looked irresolutely in the direction of the van. One of its rear doors was open. Boblansky knew at once that something unpleasant was going to emerge. He could make out a figure, moving slowly and with difficulty. At last, there she stood, barely upright, a spectre with a bloody dagger in her hand. Benito Anderson. She seemed to sway and put a hand to her head, and then she hissed at him as if she were the one calling the shots.
"Who are you?" "I'm Chief Inspector Jan Boblansky. Where's Lisbeth Salander?" "That little Jew?" she spat. "Tell me where Salander is." "I'd say she's probably dead."
The woman came towards him, her dagger raised.
"Stop right there. Don't move," he warned her.
She kept coming, as if his revolver was nothing, hissing more anti-Semitic remarks. Boblansky did not think she deserved to be shot. She must not be allowed to claim martyrdom in the hellish fraternities she inhabited, and it was Flod who fired. Benito was hit in the left thigh, and soon their colleagues came storming in, and it was over. But they never found Salander. Only drops of her blood in the van. It was as if the forest had swallowed her up. Dan seemed exhausted. He clutched his head in his hands.
"So what happened to Leo?"
Blomqvist said gently. Dan looked out through the studio windows.
He stumbled about in the trees, going in circles. He fell over and felt sick. He ate snow or drank meltwater. As time went on, he found the strength to start shouting, but no one heard him. After hours of wandering in the bitter cold, he was surprised to find himself at the top of a long slope, which he slithered down, ending up in a field. The open space seemed vaguely familiar.